So I'm here to talk to you about the technique of self-force differences. To understand what this is, consider the self-force on a particle in two different space-times that differ only far away from the particle's position. Now, the difference of these two forces is what we mean when we say self-force difference. In our particular investigation, we study the self-force difference between a scalar charge in Schwarzschild space-time and a space-time with Schwarzschild exterior and arbitrary interior. So even though, in general, the self-force difference isn't the entire self-force, there are still many advantages to studying it. For one, it's finite and easy to calculate. There's no need for any regularization. Also, once you have the self-force in Schwarzschild space-time, it's very simple to then get the self-force in another space-time with a different interior. And finally, the difference can be used to probe this notion of locality of the force, which I'll talk about now. So formally, the self-force is given by the integral of the entire past history of the particle. And so a natural question arises: how far back in the particle's history do you really need to go to calculate the force? Or more broadly, when can the force be written as a local expression? So not only is this an interesting question to study in principle, but it also might have some practical applications if we understand it better. For one, if the tail is moderately local, one could replace a particle's world line from before the tail starts to matter with anything you want. For example, if there's a zoom whirl orbit before the tail starts to matter, you could replace it with a circular orbit. And these type of tricks could make frequency domain techniques even viable for very complicated orbits. So now I'll talk about how we did some of the calculations. We were studying the scalar field equation for a non-minimally coupled scalar field. And we used the Green's functions technique to solve this. We decomposed the Green's function and the delta function into mode sums. And after simplification, we are left simply with a radial equation, as angular dependence is canceled out by linear independence of the spherical harmonics. So we choose solutions to this radial equation to correspond to the retarded Green's function. And this means that we choose ingoing radiation at the black hole horizon and purely outgoing radiation at infinity. And at the bottom there is our solution. It's matched at the delta function source. We repeat the same procedure for a space-time with Schwarzschild outside and a general interior metric that's static and spherically symmetric inside. This is sort of to model like a star or something like that. And using the same methods, we get two different radial equations, one for inside this confined ball of radius r naught, and one for outside. The outside equation is identical to the Schwarzschild wave equation. And so now, instead of picking ingoing radiation at the horizon, we're choosing the solution, or the unique solution, that's regular at the origin for the interior wave equation. And we match this solution with the exterior solution, which is the same Schwarzschild solution we just solved for. And we get a smooth correction term that's determined at the boundary of the interior metric and the exterior. So now we're capable of studying the differences in these solutions and then the fields and the forces. The difference here is actually really simple. It's just a contribution from the smooth correction term, because the Schwarzschild solution just cancels off exactly. So the smooth correction term is finite. It doesn't diverge. And it's the part of the Green's function that contributes to the difference in fields, and its derivative contributes to the difference in forces. So we'll go on to look at some specific cases. First limiting case that we did was considering a static charge outside an arbitrary interior. And when you look at the static wave equation in Schwarzschild, it reduces to the familiar Legendre equation, which has well-studied solutions. In fact, in 2000, Wiseman showed that this self-force on a static scalar charge in Schwarzschild actually vanishes. So it's important to note that we're now, the difference that we're looking at is actually now the entire self-force, because the self-force in Schwarzschild is zero. So using properties of Legendre polynomials, we can actually simplify our expression for the force. And we have this neat expression here, which if you look at it, it shows that the solution is a when the solution is a constant, the Wronskian, which is that W, actually vanishes. And this happens if and only if the interior wave equation admits a constant solution. So the self force is independent of the matter distribution if and only if it admits a constant solution. And then we can go on to say, well, the wave equation admits a constant solution if and only if it's uncoupled from massless wave equation. So the leading order self force is going to be proportional to C, which is the coupling. Okay, another limiting case that we studied was the case of a thin shell of matter at some radius R naught. Inside was flat space and outside is short shield again. And we were able to look at the far field results for the force. And here is a result that agrees with work that Fenning and Boisson had done in 2001. It shows the far field self force on the static scalar charge outside a large Newtonian shell. And we were able to extend this result to get the far field self force for a small, highly relativistic shell. And here's a plot of how the self force in the far field limit changes. As it goes to the black hole, you see it shuts off. The self force goes to zero as the radius of the shell goes to 2m. And it approaches some limiting value as it becomes a Newtonian shell. There is actually a change of sign at 5 halves m. Which is interesting. But some things to conclude from this are the self force, as you can see, is dependent on C, which agrees with what we just said on the previous slide. And in the Newtonian case, the far field self force is independent of the interior. That is to say that the radius of the thin shell doesn't come into play. But for the small, highly relativistic shell, it does. That's the R naught there. So I'm going to sort of change directions a little bit now and talk about a dynamic case. Everything we just did was for static case. And so now, as you all know, the field can be decomposed into two parts. There's a conservative field and a dissipative field. Simply, the conservative is invariant under exchange of retarded and advanced fields, and the dissipative changes sign. So I have here analytic expressions giving us the conservative field for our particle in circular orbit around a thin shell, and its derivative, which is the conservative self force and the dissipative self force, respectively. And now everything here is fine, except for we have to integrate numerically now the radial equation to get the solution, which is given by the GL omega. And so we did that in Mathematica, and now we're going to plot these conservative and dissipative forces for a particle at a certain radius, and we're going to change the value or the radius of the shell to see what effect the size of the shell actually has on these forces. So here's my plot. The particle is at in a circular orbit at radius 14m, and the shell, I'm varying from close to 2m to around 10m. And the blue line is conservative force, and the red is dissipative. But actually, this plot is of the difference in the self force. It's the ratio of the difference in the self force in the thin shell spacetime to the Schwarzschild divided by the actual self force, which we got from a paper by Diaz Rivera, Mizurataki, Whiting, and Detweiler for the conservative, and I calculated for the dissipative. So what you should take away from this graph is that when the shell is around 10m and the particle is around 14m, the difference in the force is almost 800 times greater than the actual self force without the shell. And so it appears that there's a huge effect from the shell on the conservative self force exerted on the particle, and not so much for the dissipative. Also, it's important to mention that this is for the C equals zero uncoupled case, which is why we have the results for the conservative self-force here. So this is sort of important to check that, you know, other things are working to make sure we believe this. So one of the checks we did was the constant Wronskian check, which checks integration. And we started our integration at different points in some small neighborhood and made sure we got the same results. Then there's the flux check, which is that the dissipative cell force matches the energy flux at infinity. There's a check that we did with our dissipative cell force without the shell, and that's in agreement with a paper with the results in a paper by Sam Friedman and Weissman in 2005. And then we also checked that as we bring the particles orbit out to very large R, the effects of the cell force vanish completely, which is what we expect, but it's just nice to see. So some conclusions that I'd like to say here. First, I'd like to remind you of why we're doing this, and it's because self-force differences are really easy to compute. And once you know the self-force in Schwarzschild spacetime, it's really easy to get self-force in spacetimes that are similar. And some conclusions we have is for the non-minimally coupled scalar field, which is what we're working with, the leading order far field self-force on a static charge outside of an arbitrary and spherically symmetric interior is proportional to Xi. We explicitly computed the far field static case for a thin shell. And remember that, yes, we computed the difference, but since the cell force in Schwarzschild is identically zero, we actually computed the cell force. Then we went on to compute numerically the cell force for a scalar charge in circular orbit around a thin shell, and we found that the conservative cell force difference is much larger than the dissipative cell force difference, and the conservative cell force is really big when the particle's orbit is near the radius of the shell. Thank you.
Outside the shell when the field is minimally coupled?
If it's minimally coupled, it vanishes.
I believe you are wrong.
Well, that's the far field.
The far field, yeah.
The next term.
You're wrong. The force in that case will be proportional to Q squared N squared over out of the force. So that it will be a higher order in N, but it will not be zero. Okay. Just found about 10 years ago.
So we did check, we're claiming agreement with Eric's paper. So your expression would be Newtonian only, I guess, is the only restriction. So we are saying that there's another term. Don't see how we could have missed that. This is a really easy computation.
But it would be a term which is higher order than M over R, so I would agree that the term which is Q squared M over R can vanish, but there would be a term Q squared M squared over R to the fourth.
That's what I just said at the beginning, that would be higher order, and we're keeping the leader order in peace. Notice it says leading on the next slide anyway. The leading order will be proportional to C on the previous slide.
So the other thing about the conservative component of the force, the other slide we had. No, the graph that showed the enhancement of the conservative cell force. Do you have an intuition for that?
This is sort of a recent result. Actually, I got it the week before I came here, but.
That's a question.
So why do you get such a huge enhancement of the conservative cell force when the shell is approaching where the particle is?
I mean, I guess I thought of it like the particle kind of interacting with the central object in this case, and the conservative force is sort of related to this interaction, but I don't really have it.
I think if the shell gets close, I mean, I'm just sort of imagining, you know, particles sending out photons and they're bouncing off the shell. And that's a bigger effect if the shell's right there. I wouldn't have expected it to be this much bigger. But one thing I certainly expected and was really great to see is that the conservative difference is bigger than the dissipative difference, because there's this vague idea that the dissipative self-force is some local radiation reaction thing, whereas the conservative self-force, you know, is like boundary conditions. You know, that. So you're seeing that the local dissipative piece couldn't care less whether there's a shell right next to you. That's just given by, you know, like you found.
No, so what I was wondering is whether you could think of the conservative force as being exerted by an image charge that would approach the particle as the shell is getting larger.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, I didn't really, it's not a conductor.
So. I know.
I think you can, because in that case, the force of the particle in the limit where it's very, very close to the shell is the leading order is part of those distance from the shell, and it's exactly the same as for the particle on the other side. So it's like it feels like you could maybe have such neural conditions. But then, except for this infinitesimally close distance, there's also a logarithmic term. The next order should be logarithmic, and those are different from the two sides. So only when I think you could do it only when the charge is asymptotic close to the shell, but then final photo collections would mean that you can't really have an infinite charge.
Yeah, that's certainly interesting results. Any other questions?
So I was going to ask a similar thing to what you just said. You stopped at 10 when the particle's sitting at 14.
Mm-hmm. What happened?
Numerical method breakdown, if I say what happens if the shell radius is 13.99?
No, I just decided that this graph is interesting to show. I'm going to.
And one could turn this around. Here you said we've taken the inside of Schwarzschild and flattened it out with this shell and the particle sitting outside the shell. What happens if you do the other way around? That is, what happens if you put the particle inside the shell, where it sees locally a flat space-time, but it's sitting in this, but then far away you have Schwarzschild. What's the particle's motion like then?
There is a force on the charge attracting it towards the shell.
But I mean, have you looked at that case and quantified that?
Yeah. I don't think
you wouldn't have circular orbits.
Well, if you have a static charge, let's say you ask what force do you need?
Well, moving static, particle.
But it starts moving force, it's much harder to calculate. But if you ask what's the force that you hold it static, it would suggest that the same force would be towards the shell. So if you shift it from the center, the force would be in the direction towards the shell.
I wasn't so much asking the sign. I was going back to the question you raised in your motivation. We'd like to know how local or non-local the self-force is. Right. So one would like to think that if I have a particle sitting here and it's sitting in something that shorts out everywhere except a tiny little region around the particle, does the force on the particle approach the usual self-force as I shrink the shell down? Does it, and what are the limiting cases, I guess what I'm getting at?
Well, there is people saw problems.
Yeah, this was all discussed in the
Okay.
It's a very important
question. Okay, good. All right, I need to go back and read that paper then.
No, that's the one you organized, right?
Okay, so we'll move on to the next talk. Thank you.